Let's start the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Comedian's Paradise. This is a podcast where we speak to amazing Romeos, Macbethes, characters. But we've got John Wicks from across the comedy world. Now today's guest has written some very journalistic and brilliant articles on running gigs, on not being deluded, and on helping with your material. Please welcome the fantastic, all the way from Northern Ireland, Luke McGibbon.
That was great. That was great. I like that you said help him with your material, and like I just let you pause there as well. I didn't even help you with the material of introducing me. So I'm kind of setting a bad example already. But hey, nice to meet you, Marvin.
It's all right. It all goes down here, guys. This is it. This is no words are going to be said, guys.
I just realized as well that you've got a false background there. What's the real room like? I'm just nosy.
So the real room is so I get heckled a lot at a few of the Zoom shows during the pandemic, and they say get behind the coats, or is there a dead body there? Is there the death of many comedians who bombed at my night? I don't know. There's all sorts. Are you sure you want to know in there? You don't know. It could be Don Ward from the Comedy Store.
I want to get into the heart of darkness here. I want to see the bodies.
But yeah, the only difference is that in your gig, there's probably, are they all, I could get myself trouble with it. Are they all, they're more of a certain skin color in here. This is multicultural.
No, I think that's a fair point, Marvin. We've got about, in the entire country, we've got about three black people entirely. and the country still finds a way to be racist. You'd think they would lack the material, you know, but they find a way to be racist here. I think it was the you know what? No, I can't even talk about it without borrowing a friend's material. Never mind. I was about to go into someone else's joke there. It's just, do you know what? It was a fellow called Mustafa Saeed. He's brilliant, but he says, you know, during the '80s it was all white on white racism here, and he says that was his favorite kind. You know, So. Yeah, no, they would tend to sort of err towards white. I actually did look at the demographics here once, of the country to see, like, because I care a lot about getting lineups that are representative, if I can help it. Obviously 50% of the population are women and 50% are men, so I do try and strive towards that. There's a lot less women doing stand-up, obviously, than men, so some, and often I can't reach that, but I would do my best. But I also just looked at like demographics of like skin color and things like that, just to see what I would need for it to be representative. And there's so few non-white people in Northern Ireland that I would need for out of the entire scene, out of all the comedians, for it to be representative here, because there's a few hundred, 200 or 300, I think, at last count. For among those 300 people, for it to be representative of the country, I would need a third of a non-white person to be a comedian. So just up to the waist, maybe, or, you know.
Does it help with diversity bookings? Do you occasionally lie a bit? I, Luke, I'm part mafioso Italian or something.
It doesn't hurt, I think, you know. I'm trying to make it, you know. And to be honest, like, I would talk a bit about this sort of, you know, this in that running a gig article, but like obviously there's moral reasons for lineups to be diverse, but that doesn't really change minds. I mean, what I would say is there's probably a capitalistic reason for diversity in lineups too, in that people are more likely to laugh at people who can relate to them, and people are more likely to relate to someone who's been through the same experiences as them. So, you know, sometimes there'll be a night where I'll go, oh, this crowd's not really going for anyone today. They're not really up for it at all. And then, say, a female act will come on stage and absolutely kill. And I think, you know, just that crowd just were waiting for somebody who got them. And it was primarily a female crowd, of course, as well, you know, and that just helps. Obviously, that not to denigrate the skill of that act, the person I have in mind is also brilliant. But I'm more just talking about the relationship between crowd and performer.
That's a great thing you pointed out, and this is not my point, but this is a point that one thing I love about this podcast, I've got loads of people from across the globe, and there's all these different angles. But I spoke to Gareth Berliner. Do you know of him?
I don't actually know of him now.
But he's not a comedian anymore, but he gigged from 2005, and for a while he gigged for about 15 years, and he said that one of the dangers of being a comic, if you just hang out with comedians all the time, you become less connected to people. You're just regular audience peoples. And he says one of the things is you need to mix a lot with other people, and the more people that you connect with and be funny with, the more your humor is going to be accessible across to other people. And that was a point that I never thought of before I chatted to him last week. And that was.
Absolutely. And I think, you're spot on because, like, people, crowds sometimes like a little peek behind the curtain or like hearing about what people talk about in the green rooms or whatever. But, like, a crowd doesn't really give a shit about, who's booking this gig or who secretly doesn't like each other behind the scenes. And, you have to experience things that aren't stand-up comedy because stand-up comedy involves talking about things that aren't stand-up comedy, So, like, yeah, you need to live a good life, I think.
Do you get that as 'cause do you still work as a therapist on the side, right? Or do you
Primarily.
feel that you get that from talking all the stories and mad things you hear from
Yeah.
people in therapy?
I mean, obviously nothing I can share on
Yes,
stage,
yes,
but
yes.
sadly, and sometimes people do say, oh, that must be good for material, and I'm like, well, it's the basement of human misery, and I'm sworn to secrecy, but yeah. yeah, I think so, but more even just that, I think I wrote an article a million years ago about stand-up being similar to therapy, and I would still agree with what I say in that article in that sometimes the relationship you make with a crowd is similar to the relationship you make with a client. But beyond that, there is actually very little similar between the two, I find, the more I do both of them. Both of them require different parts of me. But the one similarity that I do think they still share is that doing counselling makes me connect to people, and a lot of it is about connecting to people, and I do find the same feeling when I'm really vibing with a crowd. Whenever me and the crowd connect, I feel like we know each other in that way almost. So I would say that's probably the only similarity still. But yeah, like it but to answer your question, since I've moved a million miles away from it, like I think the counseling job does keep me connected to humanity a little bit, yeah. Though, I do find, like, so I don't do that many of the old podcasts or anything because I whenever I started, I found it very tiresome when I'd be speaking to people, other comedians, usually open micers because I run an open mic, and I'd find it quite tiresome if everyone was just trying to be funny all the time, and I was just like, ugh, so for a very long time, I was almost actively trying not to be funny in conversation. When I'm not trying to be funny, I suppose then that reverts to the sort of therapist personality, and so you end up being very much a listener in conversations. So, like, what I'm saying is, I've grown more and more boring over the years, and it's only recently I've been like, well, you don't have to be desperately trying to be funny, but do be involved in a conversation. Do try a little bit, like, not actively trying to be funny in a conversation is all well and good, but not actively trying at all basically just makes you a brick wall to people speaking to you, So I'm trying to be more loud. I think it's just whenever you promote as well, you end up having like a promoter personality as well. I'm sure you know yourself, but you end up being all business, and people try and have some crack with you at the back of the room, and you're like, yeah, you're just like you're doing like all the serious nods and everything, like, rather than I can't fully be present with you right now because I'm timing somebody on stage, or I'm biting my lip because someone's saying something shit on stage or whatever.
Yeah, I find that very difficult. Yeah, what you said in that article about the gigs, about run the emceeing the gig is, yeah, it saves you a bit of money, but I think it's damn a lot harder to emcee the gig when you run it, because
Absolutely.
you're distracted. You can't
Yeah.
just relax and engage with the audience. You're too sort of, what about this? What about that? And then you're stressed. You're
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the two personalities come into contact there, like the comedian version of you and the promoter version of you. And sometimes they have very different needs, you know, because like, okay, so, well, let's say people come into the room, a lot of audience members, you know, cowards, some might say, might veer towards the back of the room. They're like, I want to sit in the very back row. I don't want the comedian to speak to me or pick on me, blah, blah, blah. But you know, if everyone does that, then there's a few empty front rows. And so the promoter side of you has to speak to people and go, I'm sorry, mate, is it all right? It's all right if I move you to the front. We just need some people in the front row so that it's not just speaking to people at the back of the room. And that's all well and good, but then you risk damaging the relationship you have with that audience member that you're about to go up on stage and talk to them as a comedian. So like anything that you have to ask very gently so that you still have a semblance of goodwill from them whenever you come on stage. Or people trying to, oh, baby boomers are terrible for this, but haggling the price at the door, will they ever fuck off? It's like 4 quid in, and they're like, oh, any senior citizens discount? It's like your life's been a senior citizens discount, mate. Fucking just pay 4 quid. It's less than the price of a pint. Anyway, sorry, that's a bit of a gurn on my part there, but like what I'm saying is, yeah, sometimes whenever your promoter hat is on, you kind of have to, you know, stay on people's side in a way that you wouldn't need to if you weren't on. Like if I wasn't emceeing, I could just say to somebody who's heckling too much, could you leave? You need to fuck off. You need to go. Whereas if I'm about to be on stage, and like, I mean, what if there's an act on while I'm having to tell someone to leave at the back of the room, and then that act finishes, then I have to stop shouting at some stranger and run up onto the stage. Anyway, yeah, yeah, I agree with you is what I'm trying to say in a long-winded way.
And I also agree with you as well with the collecting payments things where people try, and I find that very annoying as well. And that in London, I'd say that I rarely get that actually with a lot of the paid gigs. The only gig that I've had it now is one of the ones that I've run in Wimbledon, and the thing that's a bit irritating about it, and I've done a lot of research on it, and I've said it to other people as well. But when you it is in a way when you're running a gig, this is like you're blowing your own trumpet, but it's a bit like you're running a business or something in a way.
No, it is.
And it's a
Yeah, it
bit,
is.
and if they're your friend or this or that, and they try and go in for a freebie, it's actually disrespectful to the business because you're coming in to support. And the thing
Yeah.
is, I get that at the gig with someone that I'm not really that close with, but
Yeah.
the difference in behavior of people that are my friends that come into the gig, they always insist on paying, whilst people who, you know,
Yeah.
they're not really a, yeah, I don't like that. I think that's a kind of disrespectful behavior, and it's a load of bullshit because you want to focus on running the gig. Will you just
Yeah.
that's such a load. Do you want the show to be good, or do you want to haggle over nonsense over a couple quid?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think you're onto something there as well when you say, you know, the good friends always insist on paying. I mean, yeah, exactly, you know. I wouldn't tend to charge comedians too much myself now, like, because sometimes I just respect people coming in just to watch the craft. But like friends outside of comedy, I would sort of still charge in. Or if like somebody doing their first gig might bring their girlfriend, and you can see them hang at the door just for a second longer because I think they're expecting me to say, you get a plus one. And it's like, no, they're coming to see the show, aren't they? Just they're coming to see you in particular, but they're there to see the show. And you know, we're not asking very much from people generally, are we? That like it's money so you can pay the acts ultimately.
It's and it, there's a disc. I do a discount rate as well, but that's a couple quid.
Nice.
But from but I mean, asking for free, yeah. And there's a big problem in London. You've probably heard this tons of tons from comedians from ups. Oh, there's
Bringers.
bringers and gigs are free and all that. It's a London problem, and one of the big problems with running gigs in London and the comedians as a whole, we're just in it for ourselves a lot of the times, and we're not thinking about the bigger picture. If you go to a West End theatre, they charge you 30, £40. they should be paying that sort of price to see people like Mickey Bartlett
Right.
or Bill with like top comedians, that 30,
Yes.
40. And then if you're charging that, you can then pay people a lot more. And if you build the culture of charging tickets, then you can pay comedians a lot more, and you can get comedians to stop moaning about bloody not getting paid enough.
Yeah. We actually did have a little well, yeah, we had a bit of a thing about this a couple years ago, where so like in the last, say, 4 or 5 years, the sort of Northern Irish comedy scene, it's grown a lot, and there's now money in it that wasn't there before. And when there's money in something like this, particularly in the arts, there's always going to be bad actors who take advantage of how, well, the lack of business savvy in comedians, or the fact that many comedians are so passionate they do it for near nothing. And so we had a little discussion about this years ago about how we need to get more comfortable, even just talking about money. So like, there was sort of one big promoter who was like, sort of taking people on board and like saying, "I'm having people play in their venue, by the way." So anything they say about losing money is talking out their arse. But like, so this promoter was putting people on in a venue they own and run, and charging like 15 to 18 quid for a ticket or whatever, getting about 100 people in, and then saying to the act, "So how would you like £90?" You know, which is like insane for the amount of money they probably made for that. And then the act would sort of do one follow-up question like, "That seems a little low," and then suddenly they'd be offered £500, and it's like, what? What? You know, what's the math here? And there'd be like, there'd be insistence on documentation. That documentation would be flawed. There'd be like they'd be being made to pay for things that they probably shouldn't be made to pay for. And anyway, so there's a bad actor there, and so we had a big discussion about it. I didn't ever name the bad actor because, in fact, they messaged me saying, "Are you talking about me?" And I did say no, because I think it's better that all promoters, good and bad, should feel a little bit watched. You shouldn't feel like people don't talk if you fuck them over, you know. It's better for all promoters to sort of feel like everyone's keeping an eye on you and your money, because otherwise, you know, you're leaving people open to taking advantage. And I was afraid it would sort of go nowhere, but I re really think actually talking about it like that has made things a little better here. In that sometimes people will get a gig offered to them, and then they'll message other comedians and say, they'll get told, "How much do you want for this gig?" Which is a very loaded question, because it's sort of like saying, "How much do you think you're worth?" And so they talk to other comedians and you get different answers. So, like, well, I'll give you the example that I keep in my head is that I was offered a gig there a year ago, and I was told, "How much do you want for it?" And I thought, fuck, I don't know. My heart said like 70 quid, because I wasn't being asked to do that long. And I messaged three other comedians who had done that gig in the past. I was like, "How much did you ask for?" So one of them said he didn't respond to the message and he got 50 quid. Another one said he had asked for 70 quid and then he got it. And in the third act, she told me she had asked for 150 quid and she got it. And I was like, wow, that's a big old difference there. Yeah. And so I was like, "How did you come to 150 quid?" And she just told me, like, really simple. She said, "I looked at how much they were charging for tickets. I know how big the room is. I knew the headliner was going to sell it out, so I knew they could afford it." And I was like, fuck, yeah, we should all be doing that, shouldn't we? But it's also just the fact that we felt comfortable messaging each other and saying, "How much did you get paid for this? How much do you know, and how much did you ask for?" and things like that. So like, it's very soft unionization, we'll say. Nobody here is joining Equity just yet, but like, the fact that we get comfortable talking about money means we're better able to hold bad actors to account. And it's just good to have some awareness, I think, among people, you know, especially when there's only like 300 of us, you know, no excuse not to talk to each other.
Yeah. Unless you all hate each other. No, I'm joking.
Yeah.
There's rivalries everywhere. I think
Sure.
when you're involved in this, there's always going to be people that don't like each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Though, do you know, like, And we used to be really bad for this, I thought. Not just Northern Ireland, I mean the scene in Northern Ireland, but like I think there used to be a bit of sort of comedy tribalism. I do feel like in the last 5 years, just as things started to take off, and I don't think this is unrelated, I do feel like there was a lot more focus on the spirit of cooperation and sort of cross-pollination between gigs. Like I do think a scene is like an economy, and stage time is the currency, and that if you want, I mean, I'm no politician, but I think if you want a functioning economy, you need things like, I don't know, social mobility, don't you? You need like the ability to move forward. So like a lot of the bigger gigs, it used to be a very low ceiling. The best you could hope for was doing, 20 minutes at this big room, whereas the headline spots were reserved for comedians from abroad or whatever, or one of the larger rooms here, it used to really just be about the same five or six guys being booked in every week. And because they were popular, the crowds would still come and sell out and everything. But then in the last few years, I feel like they've been, because there would be no way to get onto that gig other than just already being mates with those guys, And then like, and no, there's nothing wrong with that. I just don't think it's a great system and it doesn't help the larger scene. So in the last couple of years, I feel like they've been opening their doors a bit to other acts who they like and trying people out. And maybe occasionally they'll have an open 5 minute spot for people and just like, and I don't care if they do that once every fucking 6 or 7 months, but as long as there's an option for people, as long as there's a route, then you have a better scene in my opinion. So I do think the
Yeah.
growth in the scene is correlated to the rise in cooperation and decrease in tribalism, decrease in artistic snobbery. Because I think that was one of the big sources of tribalism here, was people going like, was people sort of going, well, I don't do dick jokes like those guys, so so I'm better than them. And it's like, well, people like them more. That's that doesn't not everything you don't like is Mrs. Brown's Boys, is what I'll say.
I've not really watched it, so I don't know. I've seen
No,
bits and
same.
pieces of it, but it's not really caught my eye.
No. It's. I mean, I used to have, I used to work with adults with learning disabilities, and Mrs. Brown's Boys was very popular in that house. So I used to watch a bit of it, and I'll say it wasn't for me, but I can see why people would like it. And I think that's the attitude that was missing when there was a bit of artistic snobbery around here, was people were completely unable, and by people I mean like the scene was so small, I'm talking about like six or seven people, but they seemed completely unable in my opinion to go, well, that's not for me, but I can see why, I can see that it is good in a different way. Like it wasn't that, it was they saw it as like, that's not for me, I am better than that. If pe more people like that than like me, they are wrong. It's I just hate that.
Yeah, that's it. My dad said something on this, but this is going to sound like complete. He says with a lot of dictatorships, this is what goes on with these countries, like because they have the attitude of tribalism, and then that it affects the whole economy. And like if they had it more like there is in the West, where it's based on merit, to a degree, meritocracy, how good you are, and it makes things better for all. And that's what you said, that could that have an effect, if this goes in too far with comedy and different art forms, could that have a really damaging effect on the art forms to other people, where they'll go off to other things because the quality won't be as good?
Exactly. I
Unlikely
think.
though.
And well, no, I think you're right though. I think that like if you end up with a scene that is like too separated, where it's like there's maybe like two big gigs and it's the same few folks in that, and then there's like an open mic scene where it's hundreds of unskilled comics going unnoticed, and some of them are fucking amazing and never to be seen by more than 30 people in a pub at a time. And like if there's too much separation between those two parts of a scene, then yeah, you're gonna get stagnancy, which I do think we did have actually. Like there's people here who are now household names, and who are brilliant and who and were always brilliant, but during by 2015 to 2019, there wasn't much growth among them as artists and in skill as a comedian, and like. Largely that's because there was stuff going on in their lives, but also I think it's because the scene was a bit stagnant because of a lack of a route upwards. But also I would say that the ceiling was quite low still there as well. Like, I think one of the big changes here was around 2017, 18, I can't remember, when local acts here started to be able to do an arena, which was crazy. I think seeing that even be as a possibility made the hypothetical ceiling a lot higher of what one could achieve here, and it made people try a lot harder. And that was one of the big things that I think made the scene here a lot better.
Is the Northern Ireland scene in a bit of an emergence, a bit of a growth? Because I hear in the Northwest, like in Manchester and Liverpool, because of hot water, you got things like
Yeah.
Have a Word and all these things going on. Like
Hi.
London's like great for getting on TV, but in terms of things going forward in comedy and like things emerging, they're saying that the Northwest is where a lot of things are happening. Is there something similar going on in Northern Ireland in that there's a big revolution happening?
I hope so. I definitely think post-pandemic that is absolutely the case. I'm always afraid of the bubble being about to burst anytime because it just seems to keep getting bigger. There's got to be a moment past which we lose it all again, but I don't think it'll ever be as bad as it was pre-pandemic. That was not as bad. As bad is the wrong word, but I don't think it'll ever be as unseen as it was before that. I think yeah, like I think what's happening in the Northwest is amazing around there, and I would say it's something similar is probably happening here, in that there's a certain what's the word? Well, there's it, basically it's the spurning of gatekeepers, isn't it? Whether that be the BBC or producers or whoever, it's very much people saying, I'm going to do my own thing, and an audience finding them, and so yeah, I do think that has happened or is happening here, and it could happen anywhere, which is great. It doesn't need to be anywhere big. I mean, Northern Ireland is, I think I looked it up once because yeah, I was thinking about this. I think Northern Ireland has like a third of the population of London or something. I can't remember. But it's wild, isn't it? Like, just the difference in numbers. So, like, the fact that they can do an arena off the back of that, it's crazy. And that's purely just off people doing their own thing. Whereas, when you have an industry that is only dominated by gatekeepers, then you only have what those gatekeepers will like. And that's all well and good, but isn't it better to have a more diverse palette of what arts can be in a country, beyond some guy in an what some guy in an office likes? Much better for art to find people in their living rooms, and or to be found by people in their living rooms, and connected with.
Yeah, like OnlyFans.
You know what though, that is a really good comparison. Like, I know, like, it is, because it's like the right so right if you I was about to say, if you want to make it in pornography, I sound like I'm on the casting couch. I'm like, if you want to be a star kid, here's what you gotta do. But like, pornography as an industry, I imagine used to have like, producers and gatekeepers, and you gotta look like this, and you have to do it like this, and you have to have these people in the crew or whatever. Whereas OnlyFans is like somebody just in their, I was about to say living room again, but maybe bedroom, I would say. Hey, maybe if you're feeling particularly kinky, why not the living room? Let's branch out. But I think, yeah, like the OnlyFans would be somebody in their bedroom, just like a cottage industry, doing everything themselves, but also making all the money for themselves. I mean, I don't know what percentage they take, but I'm assuming a bunch.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's a good example. We could start we no, the so that we could
I know
do
what you're
our own
getting at.
individual one.
Yeah. I think there are some comedians with OnlyFans out there. Like the words, like not porn, like it's like bits. I literally can't think of someone, but I could swear I've seen it on someone's link tree before. There was like an OnlyFans link, and I was like, they're doing porn, and then I clicked on it, and it was just bits. You know what I mean? Well, I mean, I didn't pay them any money, but it looked like it was just bits. Unless they're doing porn that's like that's like called buying a hot dog, or like the difference between cats and dogs or something, you know. But it looked like it was just putting bits up there.
That's all the dirty stuff, Luke.
Yeah, that's the niche, isn't it? The niche stuff. People love it when porn stars talk about the difference between men and women, you know.
God, that isn't that wouldn't that be a very strange fetish if someone sit there on their laptop and they watch the bits and they're like, right, I'm gonna celebrate over this.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it when women observe things and tell me about their life. Yeah, give me more of that.
No, it's yes, we're in a good age of entertainment at the moment, in that there's a bit of, but what's gonna, I mean, this social media age, a lot of people are doing that, but what's gonna be the next thing after that? How are people gonna get big after that? So you've got the gatekeepers, now you've got social media, what's gonna be the thing
Yeah.
after that?
Well, I think, you know, at the end of the day, you're never going to live in a world without gatekeepers. You know, someone's got to keep the gate. But I do think that, you know, it basically what we call gatekeepers, it just moves down the line further and further. So what started off as being the domain of, say, you know, producers or whatever, now that power is held by, say, people with a following, or who they can share with you, you know, people who have a big podcast or something, you know, like it or not, those people are now gatekeepers, and they have that sort of power, whether they choose to use it or not, but it is there. So like, yeah, we're never going to live in a world without that. Though, I mean, I suppose you could also argue the algorithm itself is its own gatekeeper. Like, maybe you can just, like, it's something I would often say to a lot of comics here, and it's why I don't really do any of the local podcasts unless I'm asked. But I probably should be asking, because like there are massive podcasts run by people who I like and get on with. I probably should be trying to get my foot in the door there more, but I'm trying to sort of set an example to open micers of like fucking make something, you know. Like, a lot of open micers I know, their plan seems to be, I mean, a lot of them skip the part of the plan that is get good at stand up, first of all, but their plan seems to be do these big rooms, that's it, or get on this person's podcasts, and that's it, that'll do me. And it's like, you should have a plan that isn't just clinging on to somebody more famous. You should make something, do something, do you know what I mean? Even if it's shit, like, you've already come so far in that you're making stand up, you're making bits all the time. Do something that's uniquely yours. It's more rewarding. The people who follow you because of it will connect better with you than if they just saw you chatting shit on a podcast, you know. Like, so I don't know. It does sound like a made up excuse for me not to be on the big podcast, but I think the thing is, I benefit from the fact that I have a stable career that I like and will probably do until I die. So like, I don't need to be famous. Do you know what I mean? So I don't have any need to, I guess, compromise. Yeah, so what I'm saying is, I can stay a little bit ideologically pure, in a way that if I didn't have any plans other than doing stand up as a career, I wouldn't be able to be that ideologically pure. I probably would be hustling to get on the pods a bit more, because, like, you know, Northern Ireland is being seen as a sort of comedy place these days. I would say more so than a comedy place, it's a podcast place.
Oh.
I think that's where all the big stuff is, at the moment anyway. Who knows where the culture will go within a couple of years, but it seems like the big ones here all have podcasts and things like that, and maybe they got started doing other stuff, but like, that's where it is now. And I listen to quite a lot of them pretty regularly. They're really good. But yeah, I think that's the culture of this sort of country, is it's a podcast place.
Yeah, I think what you were trying to say with what you said there was that you want to be someone that creates your own thing that gets big, and you make your own part rather than you be your own thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, like, what I really like about stand up is that in some ways it allows me to be more myself. I feel more myself. I was speaking to somebody lately about this, and they're saying, so like, they said to me, like, Well, obviously the person you are on stage is like a persona, and that made me go, oh no, I don't think it is. I feel like the person I am on stage is me if I knew I was never going to be interrupted. Do you know what I mean? Or if I knew I could leave the minute I say my piece about something. So I think that that's what stand-up does for me, and that's what I would like it to do for others. So I would be encouraging people to be aggressively themselves and to do something that is aggressively theirs.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's but sometimes people no, it's well, that's what makes stand-ups interesting. That's what I like about stand-ups as a whole is the mat. Yeah, that so many people from different backgrounds come to it. There's lots of mad stories, and we joke about, yeah, that's what I find interesting. It attracts all sorts of people from all walks of life. I'm sure that you come across a few stand-ups in a circuit that you're amazed at the trials and tribulations they've gone through to get brilliant at what they do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. I've yeah, something very specific in mind right now with like incredible obstacles in their life that they've overcome. But yeah, like you really do meet a lot of people that you'd never meet. Like I sometimes get these little moments where I sort of look around and go, how would I ever know this person if I didn't do this? Like you're in a taxi with, or no, you're in a car going to like Grey Abbey on the. So like I know that was the one that always sticks out to me. I was in a car going to Grey Abbey, which is a town on like the coast, and like way out east. And there's not much going on in Grey Abbey, but we were going to their town hall to do a gig for an alopecia charity. And in the car was myself, who at the time was a 25-year-old counselling student, a civil servant. There was a 38-year-old children's entertainer and magician, and there was a actually I don't know what age she was, but let's say late 30s taxi driver, all going down to do stand-up comedy. I was like, I would never know this taxi driver, I would never know this clown slash magician slash children's entertainer, and I would never know this civil servant. Like it's just what puts these people in a car together, you know? It's really weird. I love it.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And the moments we get in it as well. Oh,
Yeah.
God.
Yeah, you do, yeah. I gigged with Ramesh Ranganathan, weirdly, before he was sorry, I just remember that. It's not a good story. We both did the Belfast Empire, which is one of the big gigs here. And they would be getting people from across the water more often. And so I think he was sort of just on the way up. It was before he won that Leicester Mercury thing, which that seemed to be when his career skyrocketed. But oh, he was great. But yeah, seemed like a nice bloke. Still teaching. No, he had just quit teaching maths at the time. But like, yeah. Anyway, sorry. I just remembered that.
But yeah, these are the things that happen in Edinburgh Fringe. You see all the big names. It's amazing as well. You can
Yeah.
go into a coffee shop and sit next to someone famous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. As you know, do you ever meet any of your heroes?
So when I went to Edinburgh this year, well, last year, sorry, I bumped into Frank Skinner dressed as Zorro,
Oh, wow.
and then I
Were
saw
you
the
dressed as Zorro, or was he?
yeah I dressed as Zorro.
Okay. Good, do go on.
Oh, about the Zorro. Okay, so
Yeah.
my character act is I call myself Asian Zorro. And obviously, I'm a ch mixed Asian Chinese with white person, and I play that character and I put in the accent. And yeah, I put in the whole outfit. And I was just like that during Edinburgh, and I saw Frank Skinner and I said, Frank Skinner, you're my hero. And then he
Oh.
responds, says, he laughed for about a min 10 seconds or so. He says, you're my hero too, Zorro. And then
Oh, that's very sweet.
you bump into Russell Howard walking down there. You bump into Stuart Goldsmith in a coffee
Oh,
shop. Yeah,
class.
it's just mad, isn't it? You see all the big names there, and they're saying,
Yeah.
"What the fuck is this guy wearing a Zorro outfit?" But yeah,
I hope they were all nice. Were they all nice?
they're all nice.
Yeah, that's good. I met Dylan Moran once or twice, and he's sort of my hero. But I think he's just awkward. He's not unnice. He is quite nice actually. And he so it's sort of a known thing now. I think he doesn't take photographs with you, but he's very respectful. He's like a respectful no, which is kind of good, you know. But yeah, I think when I first met him, the first time I bumped into him, I was like drunk and I was like 20, and I asked for a picture and got a polite no. And since I was a bit drunk and 20, I was a bit like, oh, well, all right, you know, afterwards, obviously, not to his face, but yeah, so I used to be like never meet your heroes, and then I stopped being like 20 and was like, well, of course he doesn't want to get stop and pose for a fucking picture with every drunk moron he meets, you know.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? You see them not as a person, but you see them as some entity.
Yeah, like he doesn't owe me a picture, you know. Just trying to live his life.
I don't know what it's like for I wouldn't want to know what it's like to be, well, I wouldn't want to know what like to be with a certain level of fame that some of the people have in comedy, like Jimmy Carr, like being able to not go into a coffee shop or Starbucks without getting bothered by someone.
God, yeah, nightmare. I mean, a friend of mine in the last couple of years got famous enough that people stop him for pictures all the time, and I'm amazed by his patience. Like, just he always says yes, and he never sounds put out, even though there's loads of times where I know he's absolutely put out, and like, I just yeah, I don't know if I have that patience, you know.
What would you do if you were him? Would you say no?
Yeah, well, this is it. Actually, maybe you're left with little choice but to be polite, you know, because I can't see myself going, no, fuck off. Well, yeah, you know, because someone going out of their way to come up to you and express the kind of vulnerability that it takes to go, I like your work, you know, because people here, well, everyone thinks they're a comedian in Ireland, you know, and so sometimes people actively resent you for actively trying to do comedy, you know. So I do think it's quite a vulnerable statement here for people to say, I think you're very funny or I like your work, you know. There's a lot of defensiveness to overcome. Freud said the Irish were immune to psychotherapy or psychoanalysis, but I think he was just taking the piss, to be
I
honest.
think he
But
was Freud. Well, he did come across the Oedipus complex, so I don't know what goes through his head.
He had a lot of piss taken today, in fairness.
Now, as I've known you through the articles, is there so with the if you were to summarize to any comedians right now, what would be the questions they should ask themselves to see if they're deluded? And what would say the questions they should ask themselves if they're running a bad night?
If they're running a bad night, and what if
So
they're
they're
not?
aware of it. What questions
Okay.
should, how do they
Oh,
become
they're.
aware of them?
Oh, how did they become aware?
And those questions to find.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's a good question. Because there's levels of delusion, do you know what I mean? Like, there is a friend of mine who genuinely he does comedy when he's not in prison, and because he's in and out. But he genuinely has schizophrenia, and so you know he would actually suffer from delusions. So you know, sometimes when he gets off stage, he'll say to me, "What do you think?" And I'll have to stop and I'll go, "Well, what do you think first?" Because I want to know. And sometimes he might say, "I thought that went well," blah blah blah, and I might not always agree. So I'll say, "I think you were doing grand at this part and this part. I think this joke here, it didn't land as well as you thought," and blah blah blah. So I'm not sure if I ask any. Can I? Do you edit this? Yeah. Do you mind if I look for something on my computer right now?
Sure, okay.
Okay, because there was something I wrote down about this a while ago, and
I'll stop it.
okay. Oh shit! Wait, yeah. Should I give the background to this again?
Yeah, let's do the background for this.
Cool. Sorry, I was just saying to Marvin there, off camera, that about in 2021 there I did a gig that was so bad that I think it made me a better person. It like definitely made me a better comedian as well. And it was in Portrush. It was in the northwest of the country, and I did that gig again for the first time since then about a month or two ago, and it went a lot better. I feel a lot better about it. But yeah, it was an hour and a half drive home, and I was on my own in the car, so I had a very long chat with myself and worked through some things. And I was like, "How can I try and duplicate that? How can I make it so that you can turn a bad gig into an opportunity for growth?" So these are just some prototype questions I wrote. I never revisited them, and I haven't tried any of them yet. But I just haven't thought about it. So after the gig, what did you learn? And that can apply to you as a comedian or about that crowd. What did that mean to you? So like if that went badly or well, what does that mean to you? Does that mean that you think everyone from Port Rush is stupid, or does that mean I need to be better, or does that mean I'm a failure as a person, or blah blah blah, you know? Was it affected by drinking too much slash not enough? What did you think of them, brackets the crowd? Like, what did you think of them? Do you think these people are all dickheads, or these people are all stupid, or these people are right, I'm terrible, or did you like, I think try and be as granular as possible, you know, like, what did you think of the crowd? And then could it be true what you think of them? Could it be true? What do you think they thought of you? And could that be true? Is the feeling that you have right now similar to any other situation in your past? So that's usually regarding psychotherapy phenomenon of transference or projection. Like maybe you feel like the crowd hate you because of an experience in your past that sort of attitude felt like hatred. So is it feeling similar to any other situation in your past? Where could that be coming from? And this one I think is really important, right? In an alternate world where that gig goes well with the same crowd, what would you be doing differently or have done differently? So like I don't think it's as black and white as never blame the crowd or always blame the crowd. It's there's but sometimes it is the crowd's fault, sometimes it's your fault. Usually it's the fault of what's in between you. It's that you didn't connect, you know what I mean? So like if you meet someone and you don't get along with them, that doesn't make that person a dickhead, and it doesn't make you a dickhead. It means that the thing between you didn't quite meet. It's the fault of the in-between, you know. And I sort of, if a gig goes badly, I think like you know, even if I'm utterly convinced it's the crowd's fault, and I'm like they couldn't have liked anything, I'm like, well, what would have worked? Is there like an alternate reality where I've done something different that would have worked? Even in that alternate reality, is it just the fact that I'm Jimmy Carr in that alternate reality? If like, you know, if I had a stinker of a gig, I go, would they have laughed if I was somebody famous? And I think they probably would have, you know, the most terrible crowd in the world would pay attention to somebody famous that they know. So, you know, maybe that's what was missing, was pre-existing fame, or what is it about that person that they like? Did I have that? Anyway, sorry, I'm not really answering your original question. I've gone on to something different here. To become more aware, I mean, I suppose, how do you build a reflective capacity? I suppose what you could do is you could go completely factual and listen to recordings of your set and judge the decibels, you know what I mean, of the laughter, and maybe compare it to other sets of your own. I wouldn't compare it to other people on that night, because if you compare yourself too much to other acts, it's not good for the soul, you know. You're only really in a race against yourself here. You don't have to sort of go, I started gigging at the same time as Jimmy here, so the minute Jimmy does a bigger gig, I should start trying to do that bigger gig. That's not good for you. That's not a way to be. I think, yeah, you're in a race with yourself more than anyone else. But gosh, I don't know. I think like the thing about this reflective capacity thing is it's like I don't think it's something you either have or you don't. But I can't really. I suppose you could ask for feedback from people who you trust, you know, and create an environment with them where they feel like they can be open with you. So you can say to someone, can you be honest with me, was that bad, you know? Or can you be honest with me, how did that go in your opinion, you know? I think this is the thing, is you collect opinions and you can synthesize it rather than just take it as given. So maybe you leave the stage, you think that was amazing. You ask a friend and they say, it wasn't great. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're right or that you're right. You can put it together and say, some people thought this was good and some people thought it was bad. The ones that thought it was bad thought it because of this. And I thought it was good because of this. And it's, yeah, anyway, sorry, I'm giving a very long, rambling answer, but I do feel like just collecting opinions from others is probably a good start, just to try and course correct.
And would you say that sort of advice goes into running gigs as well?
Oh yeah, fuck, I forgot about that other part of the question. Yeah, I mean, like, usually, I think that whether or not a gig is good, it's ultimately decided by the audience, isn't it? And if do they look happy is probably a good thing to ask yourself. Do they look happy enough whenever they're leaving or in the break? Because, like, I think sometimes I'm at the back. I'm always at the back of the room at the sound desk when I'm running the night, and sometimes I'll think to myself, "Oh God, this is not going great. They're quite quiet." And then I'll come to the front of the room, maybe to perform or maybe just to collect the camera or anything like that. And I'll notice, "Oh, actually, the crowd look very happy. They're just some crowds are just a bit quieter. They show their appreciation through smiles, which is not helpful, but it's better than a crowd actively having a bad time, I think." So, like, I think ultimately that should be just the question at the root of it. Like, do the crowd look happy? Do the acts feel happy? Probably secondary to the crowd, in my opinion. But it's good to ask yourself these things.
That's true. And for anyone that, and what has been the maddest moment in comedy that, no, well, actually, no, you already answered it about that you'd go into where you came up that list. That I think that already answered that question. It was going to be, what's the maddest experience of comedy that taught you the most? But you already answered that.
Oh, good. Phew. Okay. Yeah, I think most of my learning experiences have been in comedy, to be honest. Comedy and therapy, really. Yeah, outside of comedy, I think, yeah, no, nothing that I would commit to a podcast. I'm afraid some stuff that would break
No worries.
confidentiality. Yeah.
But what is the best advice you've received from either outside of comedy or from a comedian that's helped you be a better comedian?
Oh, gosh, yeah, give me a minute with that one. That's a toughie. I think, you know what? I think it's I this isn't the words that people have used for it, and I can't really pin down anyone specific, but, like, I think there's a lot of great minds and comedic minds that have gone to waste through a lack of either organization or initiative. So initiative's the big one. Like, people who are like, "Oh, I'm never doing, and I'm not really doing that many gigs. Why does everyone hate me?" And it's like they're not messaging anyone asking for gigs. And it's like, well, that'll be why. No initiative. Like, because a bad comedian who messages promoters regularly will get 1,000 more gigs than a great comedian who barely sends out anything. So initiative and drive. The other thing, organization. Like, people who don't maybe have a place where they keep their material, or people who come up stage and they'll come on stage and they'll say, "I've not written anything, but I'll see how this goes." That can fuck off. I've no time for that. So I think some of the greatest skills you can have in comedy are completely unrelated to comedy. They're like taking the initiative and being remotely organized, having a calendar or whatever. Yeah, so those are probably the two greatest bits of advice I can give to people.
Okay. Don't be a what's it called? Yeah. Get down to
Twat.
work, guys. Yeah, don't be a
Yeah.
twat,
Yeah. Yeah, don't be a twat. And yeah, and I think just make something, for God's sake, you know.
And how do they find out about you? Like, do they find out about you through OnlyFans? Do they find out about you through a park in the woods? Do they find out about you through Crime Watch, the police, the comedy store?
I do more analog OnlyFans. I hand draw nudes and I hand them out in the
Oh,
street.
good. So there's a niche, guys.
Yeah, that's the analog style, you know. I do paintings. I'm on TikTok and Instagram. I put up little sketches and bits there, and yeah, that's about it, really. That's all I'm doing at the minute is making little sketches and things like that. I have some ideas for other things that I'm probably going to lean towards. I think there's an online course that I teach as well that you can get on Udemy. That's on sign language for adults with learning difficulties. But yeah, that's a little side hustle. So yeah, I've got a lot going on.
Right, guys, so you know where to find out about Luke. Hope you've enjoyed this episode. And make sure you give this episode a 5-star review on Amazon or iTunes. And I'll see you guys soon.